I know, it's kind of depressing, but that's the way it goes. And we're up to a very, very important mitzvah, the second most important mitzvah in the Torah. The most important mitzvah is in the next pasuk, where it talks about loving your friends, but this is the second most important mitzvah in the Torah, which is not to hate your friends. Okay? Now, there's a very interesting thing, which is if you take a look in this verse, verse 17, pasuk is dying, in the thing, comparison to pasuk Yuchet, verse 18, you'll see in the next pasuk it says, you shall love your fellow as yourself. But here it says, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. So why the language, why is the change in language? If we say you should love your fellow, we should say do not hate your fellow. If we should say do not hate your brother, why don't we say love your brother? Why is there a difference in the language between verse 17 and verse 18? You understand the question?
Fellow versus brother?
Yeah. In other words, it should be consistent. Why is it inconsistent in the term views between 17 and 18?
Because you rely on backup. For instance, like, you might teach your real brother, but since he's your brother, your parents tell you he's your brother, you have to love him. So you have to love him.
That's actually one of the pshatim they say, but, you know, we ask you to love your brother. We ask you to love your friend. Your brother we can't expect you to love, but we ask you at least not to hate him.
Right.
Yes. That is one of the common understandings of this, but not necessarily the correct one, although that it is mentioned, I've heard it mentioned very frequently. But Rav Shlomo Shaval Hirsch says a beautiful explanation. He says, you know, who are you going to hate? You're going to hate somebody who you find detestable, repugnant, right, jerk, whatever he is. So he's not your rea, he's not your friend. You hate him, right? Well, you're not supposed to hate him because of what he is. So therefore, what the pasuk is telling you is, okay, he's not your friend. He's not even your acquaintance, not your companion, not your colleague. But in the final analysis, he is your brother. Why? Because all Jews are children of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, great. Thank you.
I can find a comment.
Okay, thank you. Since all Jews are children of Hashem, so therefore the pasuk is telling us that even though you don't necessarily have anything positive to think about this person, you're still not allowed to hate him. Because the final analysis, you have the similarity that you're all brothers, you're all children of Hashem. Now, the idea of tisna, why is the Hebrew word for hatred sina? So Rav Hirsch says that it's because it's related to the Hebrew word sneh. The word sneh, anybody know what the word sneh means?
Bush.
Bush, right. And the bush was what kind of bush? A burning bush. What was it?
Thorn.
A thorn bush, right. It was a thorn bush, where a sneh is specifically a thorn bush. So when you hate somebody, you want to be thorny towards them. You want to stick some thorns into them and make them hurt and bleed. So therefore, what the pasuk is telling us here is that you're not supposed to have this form of sin off towards your friend. There's something which I don't think I've said over in this group, probably Ron heard me say in the past, but an idea which I once heard the name of Reb Chatzko Levenstein. Chatzko Levenstein was the mashgiach in Ponovich, in the yeshiva Ponovich in the year 1950s to 70s, and he said like this. He said that he was there. Let me give a little background before I get to what he said. There's several approaches in Musar. One approach in Musar is to tell people how great human beings can be, and to aspire to greatness, since you have tremendous potential. So aspire to achieve that potential. The other is to tell you how vile, disgusting, and revolting you are, and therefore you should be humble and not to get all haughty and feel how great you are. So Reb Chatzko Levenstein was more of the second approach, that people are low-based, corrupt people. But if he said like this, he said, if you would give a yeshiva bacher a gun and say to him, have you heard this from me? No? If you give a yeshiva bacher a gun and say to him, listen, you're like James Bond, you have license to kill, right? You're not going to burn in hell, you're not going to rot in prison, Nobody's going to kill you. Nobody's going to damn you. You are perfectly free, scot-free, to do with this gun as you please. So he says every yeshiva bachur would become a mass murderer. Because the fact that people don't go out, even yeshiva bachurim, and kill other people is only because there are all these constraints, like, you know, maybe having to die or to burn or whatever the case may be. So therefore, we don't kill. It's not good, not in our best interest. But were we to not have those restraints, so then every one of us would go out and start shooting people, you know, like postal workers. So it's an interesting idea, and sometimes when I say this over, people get very upset. I say, here, you guys are not getting too upset about this. But you all agree.
We know that part.
I don't agree at all.
What?
I don't agree at all.
You don't agree?
Aside from any physical, punishment that might result from killing someone, or if that was exempt, but that didn't happen, the whole feeling of guilt and that you just took someone else's life away.
Let us hope for that.
Yeah, but you hate this guy.
Oh, you hate the person.
You hate him, right?
Oh, I see.
I should be clear. It's not going to go randomly and, you know, start shooting. It's like Columbine. You know, you seek out the people you don't like and you start shooting those people. That's what you start
doing.
That's
like setting the first from Adolf.
What?
Like Hitler.
Well, something like that. The point is that you're not going to, you didn't mean that you're going to go and kill randomly, but you're going to go and perhaps kill the murderer is a better term. You're going to go out and you're going to start killing all those people you don't like. And there are plenty of them.
You don't know who you have.
I'm not sure. If they have you licensed to kill, probably even the people you don't like.
You
go out and kill them. According to Rabbi Levenstein, there's this inherent negative aspect in the human soul. It's a very depressing point, and we don't know if it's true because it's really hypothetical when one could argue the point, but there is certainly within the character of human beings this natural capacity, this drive to hate. And in Hebrew, the term which defines hatred as hatred without any reason whatsoever is, what's hatred in Hebrew without reason? Two words. Sinat chinam, right. It's hatred for nothing. Hatred for nothing means that there's no tangible reason why I hate you. In other words, if I hate you because you have an ugly face, that's not a logical hatred, right? That's sinat chinam. That is considered to be hatred for nothing. Worse is, and in fact, you know, in the Matzah, when we daven on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur, we say one of the things we say in the vidui, in the confession, is Al-Chet Shechatan V'Nach V'Sin Aschinam, by the hate, the sin which we sinned before you with hatred for naught, for nothing. And one of the commentaries there in the Siddur says the Sin Aschinam is so powerful that there is nobody who is completely free of it. And even the greatest people, even great Talmid HaChamim, are not free of the trait of Sinah. And he says, what does it mean? It means even your close friends, let's say you have a close friend who got a special prize, or a special award, or accomplished something unique. So very often, your first response, or at least part of your first response, will be jealousy, will be feeling, I should have gotten that. Or why did he get it? And that's really what you're supposed to do, is have the attitude, well, I am so happy that you got this prize. But there's a natural human tendency, again, even in great scholars, great Talmid Chachamim, to feel slighted because this guy got an honor. And that's a big, big problem. That's a major Musar battle to try and eradicate that feeling. The Gemara says, b'chol adam iskane, and every person, a person gets, vis-a-vis any other person, a person will become jealous, except for vis-a-vis his son, and some people say also his student. Meaning a father will not be jealous if his son accomplishes more than him, and some say also that a Rebbe will not be jealous if his Talmud accomplishes more than him. But anybody else, the natural human tendency is to be jealous.
Is that because the Rebbe or the
father, that his job is to teach this person. So if this person excels and learns even more than him, then that means that he did his job good. So it's actually like a personal
job. It could be that, but it could also be that that it's an extension of himself. So it's his, not just, I think we're saying similar things. But in other words, if I teach you and you go and accomplish something, so it's my teaching which really, you know, brought you to that place. So that's why I would take pride as opposed to getting jealous. So the question is why God created this concept of jealousy, of hatred. It really seems to be not fair, right? It stacks the deck against us if we have this innate trait of jealousy, this intrinsic problem within our souls. So why do you think God created a trait of jealousy? Right, but that's not the correct answer.
There could be some like tricky odd stuff so we can overcome it and become better people through it.
What did you say before that? Some what?
Khaki.
Khaki?
Like cockerini.
No, khaki.
Oh. we need a translator, I'm sorry. The idea which Justin doesn't like is the idea to say that God created it in order that we should overcome it. In other words, that this is a negative trait, which of course it is, which we have to overcome. So that is partially true, because obviously every negative trait we have to overcome, but there must be a positive trait also. In other words, there's nothing which God created, which is in terms of human drives and traits, which is absolutely negative. There has to be some positive to it. And the assumption which we have is that there is something a person should hate, not another person, but rather ideas. There are certain ideas which a person should repudiate, a person should find disgusting, and a person should get angry and hate them and detest them. Now, it's interesting, there actually is a big question, for example, about Amalek, right? We know that there is a command to eradicate the memory of Amalek. So there's a question is like this. When I go and kill an Amalekite, it's not a mitzvah on an individual, but let's say hypothetically that it was. So I'm going over to throttle an individual Amalekite. So do I go over with great simcha, with great happiness, that I'm about to fulfill the mitzvah of mechias Amalek, of destroying, eradicating the Amalekite? Or do I go over with anguish and say, woe that I have to do this? How unfortunate it is that I have to eradicate him, but I have no choice.
Isn't there a whole thing when you're crossing the Dead Sea? How there's a whole thing how we couldn't be too happy because the Egyptians were dying?
It's interesting that it doesn't say that the Jews shouldn't have been so happy. It says the angels shouldn't have been so happy. God rebuked the angels for being so happy, not the Jews themselves.
And why do we take wine out of our cups?
That's only one reason which is given for that.
Okay.
The others have the same
reason we were given.
The less politically correct reason is that we want that kind of socket to them of punishment which is inflicted on the Egyptians to be inflicted on all the other enemies. So we're taking from the cup and applying it to everybody else. Some more militant explanation. So it's actually a matter of dispute. What exactly the attitude has to be towards eradicating evil people. So Rav Kook is famous for having said that when a true tzaddik goes to kill an Amalekite, he does so out of great anguish. He feels bad and he has to kill the Amalekite. Other people would found that strange because they said that it's a mitzvah like any other mitzvah in the Torah, right? So therefore, he should be happy when he goes to the mitzvah. Now, this is not so simple because, you know, there's also a mitzvah in Torah to divorce your wife. But it's one of 613 mitzvahs. So therefore, when you go to do the mitzvah of divorcing your wife, you're supposed to go with simcha? You know, you're supposed to go, you know, with a band?
Yeah. They used to do that. The Gemara talks about big parades they would have sometimes, like for like little barrels in the street or something. Like.
That's when they got married. Now we're not divorced.
The other stuff. Turn this around.
So that's a similar idea. What is the status of those kinds of mitzvahs, like get, which is really a negative, not a positive command to give a get, but it's under negative circumstances. So the bottom line is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whether we're supposed to have sense of happiness or a sense of sadness when we must detest or eliminate other people, it's certainly the case with bad ideas, bad stuff, that eradicating them is a good thing. And distancing ourselves from evil is a good thing, and therefore the attribute of sinna was created in order to detest that which is truly detestable. David HaMelech says, the way he puts it is, Mitzanecha Hashem Esno. King David says, those who hate you, God, I hate them too. So it's really directed at those people or those ideas which will go in opposition to God.
Everyone should try to fulfill as many of the 613
mitzvahs
as possible. Does that mean we should marry someone, divorce them, marry someone else, just so we can fulfill the mitzvah of get?
No, you're not supposed to fulfill.
Who says
you're supposed to fulfill all the 613
mitzvahs?
No, you can't fulfill all of them, but I mean...
No, you're not supposed to strive. Strive to fill as many as possible?
No.
So what about these people in Israel who, like, purposely get, like, a firstborn donkey and, like, chop its neck and things like that?
Well,
and they like seek out mitzvahs, like, or
they
like searching for a bird's nest to shoot away the mitzvahs.
They don't chop the neck off. They redeem it
for a
redeem it for a goat or a sheep. But the bottom line is that some people seek out mitzvahs because they're unique and they get a kick out of that, and you know, they should. It's interesting thing. But the certainly not supposed to seek to fulfill many mitzvahs in the Torah. Another example of a mitzvah a person is not supposed to seek is there is a mitzvah to kill people who are liable for death. Right? So you don't, so a person says, oh, I want to become the executioner because I want to be the person who fulfills that mitzvah. There is no mitzvah to pursue that position of the chief executioner who's going to go and kill the sinners. So there are many different mitzvahs that we don't strive necessarily to fulfill. But again, getting back to the motif here, so sinner was created for ideas and perhaps even for people who are bad. But no Jew is fully bad. No Jew is fully bad, and therefore you're not supposed to hate any of your brothers.
Even if he's put in terror.
Right, you're not supposed to hate him. You're supposed to, you know, be sad that you have to stay away from him, but not supposed to hate him as a result. I'm not saying it's always possible.
You can hate what he says, though, right?
Right.
And the ones that, you know, the mitzvot, if you don't do them, it says you'll be cut off from your people.
You still can't hate them.
But they aren't our people anymore.
No, but they're cutting off there is not literal, it's figurative, right? As long as they're alive, they still can do tshuva, they're still part of the Jewish nation. Right? But it says here, very interestingly, what does it mean? Don't hate your friend in your heart. Meaning, I'm allowed to come over to you, this will be the end of what the end of the passage says, I can come over to you and say, Reuven, I hate your guts, and this is why. That's permissible.
Aren't you supposed to?
What?
Aren't you supposed to?
Yes. That's even, as we shall see, it's laudable. But what you now have to do is preserve that anger, that hatred inside your heart, and let it fester and grow and become something, you know, even more violent, even more disgusting, and even more debilitating. What you're supposed to do is go and discuss the issue with your friend. Again, don't hate him in your heart. You can go and speak to him about your hatred, but don't retain it in your heart as a grudge.
So you can go to someone and say, excuse me, hi, I find you completely annoying. Can you please stop talking to me? I'm just hating you more and more every time I see you. Can you just leave me alone?
In theory, you could do that.
And you're supposed to do that?
It's not
rather than, like, just, like, try to evade or just take the abuse and just, you
yeah.
know...
Unless, this is a big unless, it's going to be counterproductive. Which may well be, right?
Right.
So, it's not going to be counterproductive. You're supposed to really go over to somebody and say, now, if somebody's talking to you in davening, right? And you really, if you find it drives you up the wall, right? Because they are completely disturbing your kavana. So, you should really go over to them and say, listen, Yanko, you are a jerk. This is why. Please do something that I don't use the word jerk. This is why I'm upset at you, and this is what you have to say.
You can't, like, embarrass them. That's a big thing, right?
Yeah, do it in private, not in public.
I mean, I've heard stories of, like, some real, like, Saudi said, like, they have, even as much as, like, they were, let's say they, one story I heard was a man took a taxi, and the taxi driver accidentally closed the door on his hand.
I don't know who
and obviously this guy's in excruciating pain, and the cab driver didn't realize it. He didn't tell him.
He kept it to himself with an excruciating pain until he was at home, and then when he was with his wife, she took him to the hospital. I mean, to go as far as to something like that, where it wouldn't have been terrible if he mentioned that that happened, that's kind of like the opposite in terms of, like, you could just really, like, within yourself, let it go.
The interesting thing is that there's the story told about Moshe Feinstein, but he never told it out, right? So, but there was something else, really. We're talking about a person has no sense of being wronged by the world. In other words, the person has gone to such a level which most people don't achieve, where it doesn't matter to him what happens to him, good or bad. The way that's expressed in English is with the term equanimity. A person finds it equal, finds no difference in terms of whether somebody else did him a favor, somebody else did him an evil, because he's connected to Hashem and accepts everything Hashem sends his way with love and with understanding. So such a person who has capacity to do that, to allow the grudge, in which the grudge dissipates very, very quickly, he doesn't have to go and say to the person, listen, I hate you, or whatever terms that effect. But if he's not like that, then he has to do it. It's interesting that there's a book which contains letters written by Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner was a great Rosh Hashiva in the United States in the mid-20th century, died in 1980. And the letter is a two-word letter. He said one-line letter he sent to one of his students on Erev Yom Kippur one year. And the letter said, Dear XYZ, whoever it was, it doesn't say it in the book, I'm writing you this letter to let you know that I don't forgive you. Yitzchak Huttner. So what's the idea of writing a letter to I don't forgive you?
Is that usher not to forgive someone?
What?
No,
it's only usher not to forgive someone if he came with you three times in front of a minion.
Oh, but you can push him off twice.
Right. And it has to be in public. So Putin is expressing this idea, right? Let's say he wasn't for this bumper, I need to tell you that you're still guilty. And even if I say I forgive you, it's not going to be true. I'm lying to you, I'm lying to me, because I'm not willing to forgive you, because you did something disgusting to me. So that's what Putin was expressing in that letter, to know that the times when an extra special effort is required, otherwise even a verbal mechila is not sincere and not meaningful. Okay? Now the rest of the pasuk follows in this respect. The pasuk says, Hocheach tochiach et amisecha. Hocheach amisecha means, you shall translate it, you shall reprove your fellow, and do, etc. So what does it mean you shall reprove your fellow? The reason I ask you is that word reprove. It's a very obscure English word, right? How many times in your life have you used the word reprove?
Which
one,
you think?
Yeah. If you use it once, that would be more than I think. So the reason why I ask you is the word reprove, I think, is because it comes to the word proof. And hochacha in Hebrew means a proof. And you're supposed to go to your friend and prove to your friend that what he did was wrong. The Shamsul had a somewhat obscure etymology derivation of the word hochiach, or hochiach tochiach, but I think it's simple. It comes to the word koach. The word koach means you demonstrate to somebody powerfully. In other words, not the power of punching him in the face, but rather the power of your evidence is what allows you to go and tell this person that this is what you're doing wrong. Now, it works in both Benonim HaMacham and Benonim HaChavero, both in sins between you and God and sins between man and fellow man. But you have to go over to him and say, Yankel, this is what you're doing wrong. And you should know I have negative feelings towards you, and it's because of X, Y, Z. Now, unfortunately, the Gemara already says, this is already the Gemara, the Mishnah actually, 2,000 years ago, Rabbi Tarfon says, in our day and age, there's nobody who's willing to accept such kind of reproof. And Rabbi Akiva says, in our day and age, there's nobody who's capable of giving that kind of reproof. Right? Because you have to be able to say it and receive it in a positive way. But generally speaking, most of the time, when I come to reprove you, I'm trying to rebuke you. I'm trying to say that you're an idiot. Right? So that is not considered to be a legitimate form of reproof. or rebuke, because it's not going to, it's only, at best it's only going to make you defensive. It's unlikely that if I come to you and say, you are an idiot, that you are going to respond favorably and with a willingness to change as a result. So what Rabbi Akiva is saying is that nobody knows how to do it right anymore. Because everybody, when they do it, they get involved just into a greater fight. So therefore, he says, it's not possible to do tochacha, to do proper rebuke in our day and age. It's beyond the capacity of human beings to do. It's no longer relevant.
So why do people try?
What?
Why do people try? Like, rabbis give schmoozes and rebuke to their congregations, and people give rebuke to each other. We should never do it then, right?
In theory.
We can't do it properly, so I should never say, you know, what you're doing is wrong. It's impossible for me to do it right.
Well, there are exceptions to the rule, but theoretically that's the case, right? You want me to say over my Pinocchio essay?
Huh?
That's what I thought about Pinocchio.
Right.
The,
Pinocchio?
Yes. You didn't know I wrote the story of Pinocchio, did you?
What?
You didn't know I wrote the story of Pinocchio, did you?
I didn't know that you knew this.
I never knew
that you knew it.
Okay, the,
I'll eat your house.
What?
I'll eat your house, then.
You've been in my house?
For pizza.
For pizza, okay.
I never...
Is that where you live?
No.
What?
I never even knew it until you started reading the book to me.
Oh. So the, I once wrote an article, which was not published.
will be published.
Will be published.
Yeah.
You should approve the editor.
I rewrote it to the specifications to draw Pinocchio. But the article was originally based on Pinocchio because there was once in a shul, and I'm not sure if this was Ron was referring to, but this is a similar case. There was once in a shul here in Muncie where the rabbi, a well-known rabbi, was giving a drasha, a very nice drasha. At the end of his drasha, he said, so the moral of the story is, you should get rid of your television. I'm just exaggerating, but that's basically what he said. So I found that very strange. He said, because, listen, I know they're not going to get rid of the television just because of the speech. He knows that they're not going to get rid of the television because of the speech. The congregation knows that the rabbi knows that they're not going to get rid of their television because of the speech, right? And the rabbi knows that the congregation knows that the rabbi knows that they're not going to get rid of the television because of speech. So why are we going through the motions? What's the point, right? It's a meaningless thing. So that's when I realized that human beings, all human beings, are like Pinocchio. How are we like Pinocchio? What?
Reliable.
No. Where's Pinocchio's conscience? Right. Pinocchio's conscience was outside of him. Right? Have you seen the movie?
I've only read the original story.
Oh, the original story is nowhere as good as that, near as good as the movie. Disney did a much better job than Karate. Usually it's the other way around, but in this case the movie's much better than the book.
I'm trying to think, I find the magic singing cricket in...
Right, the cricket in the book
has
a very small role. But it's interesting that in the book, the cricket gets squashed. So he squashes the cricket. Because the cricket started telling him all sorts of nasty things about himself. So...